unabashed.
The most unpredictable
becomes a headline.
The most volatile,
outrageous behavior,
unsubstantiated narratives,
a battle of personalities.
Welcome to Grant Thamashia, a co-production of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the Hindustan Times. I'm your host, Milan Vaishnav. The decline of India's parliament is a refrain that has often been repeated over the last 75 years of modern Indian democracy. A new book on India's parliament addresses the decline thesis head-on and provides a warts-and-all assessment of India's legislative chamber. The book is called House of the People, Parliament and the Making of Indian Democracy, and its author is the scholar Ranajoy Sen. Ranajoy is a senior research fellow at the Institute of South Asian Studies at the National University of Singapore. He's a veteran scholar of Indian democracy, having studied at the University of Chicago with two of the leading lights of contemporary India scholarship, Lloyd and Suzanne Rudolph. I am pleased to welcome him to the show for the very first time. Ranajoy, thanks so much for coming on and congratulations on the book.
Thank you, Milan. Thanks for having me here.
So I want to start with the very, very big picture. At the very start of your new book, you write that understanding parliament is central to understanding, quote unquote, the puzzle of Indian democracy. And I think that's maybe a good place to start. If you could help unpack for our listeners, what is the puzzle of Indian democracy in layperson's terms? And what role do you think parliament plays within it?
Right. So I think, you know, one of the puzzles of Indian democracy is the, you know, its longevity. You know, when India becomes independent in 1947, I think there are very few people who believe that Indian democracy is going to stay the course. You know, there are all sorts of predictions that it's going to last 5 years, 10 years, maybe a couple of decades. But as we have seen, Indian democracy has fairly successfully now completed, you know, 75 odd years of existence since 1947. And any parliament in the Westminster system, which India, of course, adopted in 1947, a parliament sits at the apex of representative institutions in a country and hence is, you know, critical to its functioning. And in the Indian case, especially when many observers did not give Indian democracy much of a chance to survive, parliament, which was convened after elections that were held in 1952, in the face of considerable logistical difficulties, was in many ways symbolic of Indian democracy itself. Indeed, Indian parliament was held up as a beacon or a sort of shining light for the other newly independent nations of the time, since many nations were becoming independent in the late 40s, early 50s, around the same time as India became independent. India, in fact, although federal in name, has always been centralized in its functioning. In fact, one of the reasons the 1946 cabinet mission failed was due to the center being weak in that proposed scheme. Hence, I would argue that parliament, where you know, national policies are debated and formulated and its functioning, is a critical barometer of the institutional health of Indian democracy.
So, Ranajoy, I want to ask you a little bit about this origin of Westminster parliamentary democracy. You know, many critics of democracy in India have argued that India's constitutional drafters essentially erred when they decided to replicate the British model in India. In your book, you sort of tackle this head on, right? And I want to quote here, you say, "It's time we recognize that the Indian parliament is not only a magnified or multiplied version of its British forebear, but has also evolved into a different kind of institution, for better or for worse, whilst keeping its Westminster trappings," end quote. What is it that you think the critics are missing when they simply say that India has copycatted or just aped or mimicked the British system?
Right. You know, just to address the first part of your question, it is important to note that there were no serious or meaningful discussion in the Constituent Assembly, which, you know, drafted India's constitution between 1947 and 50, about any system other than the Westminster system. And in fact, I use a quote from Jawaharlal Nehru at the beginning of the first chapter, saying something to the effect that India must adopt a system that fits with the temper of the people of India. And there were others like K. Munshi with a very different ideological bent who argued along similar lines, saying that for nearly a century, Indian public life has drawn on the traditions of English constitutional law. So in a sense, that's important to note, that India and Indians at 47, in 1947, were really used to or comfortable that with that one particular system. And hence, there was very little sort of debate on that. You know, although there were a few stray voices, like the constitutional advisor to the Constitutional Assembly, Sir Benigal Narsingh Rao, who argued for a presidential system, but that did not find much traction. There were a few voices, too, who put forth a vision of Gandhian decentralization. Of course, we must remember that Gandhi was not part of the Constituent Assembly, but these two were fairly marginal voices. So there was really a consensus on the Westminster system. And in fact, future British Prime Minister Clement Attlee, who had visited India in the 1930s, had suggested the presidential system. And he was quoted as saying something to the effect as that it was as if he had offered the Indians margarine instead of butter when he was talking about the presidential system. Of course, in the assembly, there were a few dissatisfied voices. And, you know, there were a couple who very notably said that they had hoped that the English band would, you know, give way to the, you know, what they said, the mellifluous notes of a veena or sitar, but that was not to be. So what India adopted was essentially the British model. But it's also important to note that there were, you know, certain tweaks made in terms of procedures, the half-hour discussion, for instance, the business advisory committee, etc. But I think it was the scale and diversity of Indian Parliament that was really, charted a new course for the Indian version of the Westminster system. And this was noted fairly early on by a very not too successful British Prime Minister, Anthony Eden, who said that Indian Parliament was not a pale imitation of British Parliament, to quote him, magnified or I think he used the word multiplied, a reproduction of the House of Commons. So in a sense, I argue that even though India adopts the Westminster system and it does without a very serious debate, there is a consensus on that, the trajectory of Indian Parliament shows that, it evolves into it's sort of a different kind of beast from what the Westminster, the parliament, the mother parliament, was.
The first part of the book narrates what I call the constitutional prehistory of legislative institutions in India, and that dates back to, the middle of the 19th century. And in that prehistory, you argue, contrary to some scholars, like Sunil Kilnani, among others, that, despite whatever shortcomings there may have been in representative institutions in colonial India, they still nevertheless helped to create a constitutional ethos that in some sense anticipated the dawn of the Indian constitution. And just to help unpack that for us, it's easy, I think, to write off these institutions as being unrepresentative, unequal, just fundamentally inadequate. But in your account, they do play an important role.
Right. I think too often and quite unexpected, quite expectedly, and we are all guilty of that, the exciting arena of nationalist politics has largely overshadowed the limited constitutional reforms, put in place by the British from, the mid to actually the late 19th century, post the Great Uprising in 1857. So that always overshadowed, the rather sedate happenings and discussions inside the representative assemblies. But it is fairly obvious that these assemblies, even though they were limited in scope and elected on a very limited franchise, provided a training ground for independent India's elected representatives. And according to W.H. Morris Jones, who in fact wrote the sort of first standard history of parliament in the 1950s, according to his calculations, nearly half the MPs in the first Lok Sabha had prior legislative experience from the British or the colonial era. Beyond that, besides the experience that independent India's MPs gathered in colonial India, one, I think, should not underestimate the debates on the floors of the Central Assembly or the state legislatures in colonial India, where stalwarts like Gokhale or Lala Lajpat Rai or even Jinnah, took part and critiqued colonial policy. It was another matter that some of these critiques were, fell on deaf ears. But I think these assemblies provided a platform for Indians to vent their grievances and to articulate them. And finally, the experience of Indian politicians in local government is, I think, too often underestimated. So if you see from Nehru to Sardar Vallabhbhai Patel to Netaji Subhash Chandra Bose, all of them, and we forget this, had experience in municipal government. In Nehru in Allahabad, Patel in Ahmedabad, and Bose in Calcutta.
You know, just to kind of circle back to the whole debate that the Constituent Assembly had, one of the aspects of the Constitution that I find the most stunning, right, in some sense, is the decision to grant universal adult suffrage from the outset, right? No phase in, no caveats, anyone of the eligible age, regardless of caste, creed, gender, so on and so forth, able to vote. And you note in the book that this was one of the most revolutionary aspects of the Constitution, but also one in which there was almost near unanimity, right? Very little debate. Does that absence of debate surprise you?
You're absolutely right. The lack of debate in the Constituent Assembly on universal suffrage, which is a radical step, is somewhat surprising. However, if you look at the history of the Indian nationalist movement and its attitude towards this issue, we find that from the 1920s, the Indian National Congress had strongly backed universal adult suffrage as one of the principal conditions of independence. In fact, the very famous 1928 Nehru Report had advocated adult suffrage, and the 1931 Karachi Resolution also formally adopts it. Subsequently, much closer to independence in 1945, you also had the Sapru Committee Report, which also comes out in favor of adult suffrage. So there is a history, at least within the nationalist movement and the Indian National Congress, on the on the importance and the imperative nature of adult suffrage once in India becomes independent. Although we must note that there were some Constituent Assembly members who did express unease with adult suffrage, and one of them, called Brajeshwar Prasad, whom I quote in the book, calls this a grand leap in the dark, and I'm quoting him. Outside the assembly, there is some evidence of some of the assembly members also voicing their unease, and there is a speech where Rajendra Prasad, the first president of India, independent India, reportedly voicing his anxieties at a public meeting about adult franchise. But by and large, in the assembly itself, we don't find too many voices against or critiquing this idea.
You have a very interesting part of the book, which then goes into the real practicalities of Parliament, how it functions, and who's in Parliament. What does the composition look like, right? And in one of those chapters, you trace the changing demographics of Parliament over time. And you note very clearly that Parliament is getting older, even as India's population continues to be very young, right? And, some people have said, look, India is in danger of turning into a gerontocracy, right? Or a polity run by essentially very, very old people that is increasingly out of step with, say, the median citizen or the median voter. Tell us a little bit about, that discrepancy. And, does there come a time when that mismatch between who rules and who is an Indian comes into conflict?
Right. That's an interesting question. I don't know whether I have a clear-cut answer to that. Indian Parliament, although I think this current Parliament is marginally younger than the earlier ones, but still, the average age is sort of in the mid to late 50s, whereas you're right, India is a very young nation, and a majority of the country's population is definitely, I think, under 30. I did some sort of looked at some of the numbers and statistics in terms of the extent to which, for instance, younger members of parliament, say those under 30 or under 40, you know, participate in debates, you know, ask parliamentary questions, you know, how often they attend parliament. And I found that, you know, the numbers for the younger MPs are not actually better than the older MPs. In fact, the older MPs tend to do better on all these counts. So at least on in terms of, you know, taking parliament seriously, it seems that, you know, older parliamentarians are actually doing better, at least on these indices, than younger MPs. On the question of whether they are able to articulate the concerns and cater to the, you know, to the needs of a very young constituency, you know, that bit I haven't really sort of done research on, but I've found some evidence, you know, and this is not my own research, but others, and I've cited, I think, a couple of papers where it shows that, you know, across a range of democracies, using various parameters, it's not necessary that, you know, younger MPs or younger representatives are actually articulating the concerns of the younger population necessarily better than older MPs. So I guess in India too, I would think that that is also the case. But you're right, there is a concern about, you know, and I think MPs in the 50s and 60s are fine, but we do also have a set of politicians who are you know 80 plus, you know, some even closer to 90. So, you know, there is probably a point where we do need to decide where there should be a sort of retirement age for politicians. But I think there is no democracy probably anywhere where there is a retirement age in that sense. So I think, India might have the demographics in that sense, an older set of MPs. But, you know, I think it'll be sort of difficult to put in place a sort of cutoff age whereby, you know, MPs should stop sort of either contesting elections or, you know, entering parliament.
Hey, Grant the Masha listeners, thanks for listening to the podcast. Putting this show together each week is a labor of love, but it takes a lot of work to put out a great show every week. If you'd like to support the work we do at Grant the Masha, please visit ceip.org/donate. Don't forget to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or on your favorite podcasting platform so you'll be the first to know when a new episode rolls out.
In addition to composition, as I mentioned before, you also talk a lot about the processes and procedures that underlie Parliament's functioning or dysfunction, as the case may be. You dwell at some length on the issue of parliamentary disruptions, which of course are legion. And, you know, I think one of the puzzles here is that, you know, speakers, the person who is the official chair of the legislative body, you know, they do have the authority actually to crack down on those who seek to disrupt parliamentary proceedings. And yet it seems that they rarely ever do. And I'm wondering if in your research, you know, you have an answer to this question of, you know, why is it that speakers are so accommodating? You know, do you think a more forceful, perhaps more coercive approach could tame, you know, some of the worst excesses when it comes to sort of bad behavior on the floor of parliament?
Right. You know, I think that's a very interesting question. There are two, you know, possible reasons for the reluctance of speakers to intervene and enforce the rules. And you're right, there are rules to penalize, members who disrupt parliament. So one of the reasons I would say, as a rule, speakers in India historically have largely been very weak and have too often followed the dictates of their party. So they haven't really been independent, unlike, say, speakers in some other, you know, Westminster democracies, including in the United Kingdom. And, you know, I quote a legal scholar who uses a cricketing analogy, which might be lost on some outside, that the speaker is somewhat akin to an umpire or a referee being appointed by the batting side or the side in power. So that is possibly one of the reasons. But second, and I think that might be a more important reason, is that, strict disciplinary measures, for example, banning members from taking part in parliament procedures for a certain period of time has usually been counterproductive. And this view has been articulated by, you know, several speakers, and most notably, and I quote in the book, one of the vice presidents of India, Krishan Kant, who was the chairman of the upper house of the Rajya Sabha, who actually said that the presence of rules often provokes the urge to break them. And of course, this is a human impulse that is, you know, present outside of parliament. But the tendency of speakers in India to take what I call this conciliatory or accommodative approach could also perhaps be traced, if you sort of look at the history of speakers in parliament, can be traced back to Mavalankar, whom I mentioned a bit earlier, the first speaker of the Lok Sabha. And Mavalankar in 1953 or 1954, had once, on the question of walkouts and disruption, said that, you know, over time, political parties will sort of give up the disruptive activities. And he said that any attempt to impose rules or regulations is likely to worsen the situation and more likely to turn up the backs of those who are doing this. And he believed that over time, legislators will start behaving more responsibly. So I think a lot of successive speakers have sort of taken Mavalankar's, approach, this sort of conciliatory approach, to heart. But unfortunately, I think, Mavalankar's hope that disruptions and disruptive behavior would disappear has not come true. In fact, I think disruptions have been on a constant sort of upswing, and we've seen, not in this current parliament and the earlier one, but the one from 2009 to 2014, we saw parliament being very seriously disrupted. So, there has been an uptick in disruptions definitely over the last, two decades or so.
Various sections of the book are devoted to the question of corruption, self-dealing among legislators. It sort of comes up in various forms, across many chapters. And you note that there is a real lack of clarity around conflict of interest in India, right? So everybody knows it's an open secret, lobbying exists, but only in the shadows. I'm wondering, why do you think it is that, there hasn't been a greater move towards actually building a legal and regulatory framework around this set of issues? After all, politically, it actually seems like it might be, popular with voters, right, who are no dummies, who understand that favor trading and horse trading and the kinds of activities that take place on Capitol Hill and K Street in the United States, happen in New Delhi as well. So, is there a way forward to actually bring some of these issues to light, perhaps in a regulated sense?
Milind, the political parties and politicians have been rarely interested in this kind of regulation, at least in India. The impetus for much of this has actually come through Supreme Court rulings. So, for instance, and you've done, very good work on this, on the criminality of politicians, on the wealth of politicians, etc. And the very fact that now we know which MP has a criminal record or what kind of assets he or she has is actually due to Supreme Court rulings in that sort of 2001-2002 phase, where the Supreme Court actually ruled that elected representatives, both who are elected as well as, those who contest elections must, in an affidavit, state A, their, assets, and B, whether they have a criminal record or not. And left to the political parties, I don't think they would have done anything. And this is true for other issues like, conflict of interest. There has been some movement in terms of, MPs declaring their conflict of interest, but that has been incomplete. So, for instance, if you look at, the committees, the committee system was expanded in a big way from the 1990s, you find that in a lot of the committees, you know, members, you know, sitting or deciding on issues in which they're actually stakeholders. For instance, for a committee that's deciding on say, matters regarded to civil aviation, for instance, you'll have actually, you know, a member who probably has a stake or who owns an airline. Or similarly, you know, someone, you know, debating in a committee or discussing the issue of regulation of tobacco, you'll find someone, you know, who's either an owner of a tobacco company or has a stake in a tobacco company. So there are sort of multiple such examples that one can give up. So unfortunately, you know, there has not been, you know, any initiative or, you know, sort of serious, you know, excepting for stray initiatives taken by individual MPs. Political parties as units have not, you know, taken any serious step forward. And one of the reasons, you know, I think for this is that, and again, this goes, I think, goes back to some of the work you have done, is that, you know, it looked, much of political and electoral funding is very murky and opaque. And you've powerfully documented this in your both your book and your other work. And this, I think, leads to, you know, the reluctance of politicians and elected representatives to really sort of clean up the system. And I might add here that the issuing of electoral bonds by the current government has actually done nothing to clean this up. In fact, it has made the situation even murkier.
Roger, I want to sort of back up a second and sort of zoom out again to the macro picture. You know, when you sat down to write this book, you were fundamentally interested in two sets of questions, right? Number one, is Parliament working to articulate the diverse demands of a diverse polity and translate them into legislative action? That's kind of, you know, one set of concerns. The second really is about how the practice of Indian democracy has transformed the institution of Parliament, right? And so, you know, maybe let's just start with the first for a second. You know, as you reflect on this book and some of the lessons that are in it, some of the history and some of the research, you know, what is your principal takeaway about the effectiveness? You know, 75 years on, you know, should Indians be proud of the work that Parliament has done to essentially, you know, manage this unprecedented diversity and sort of channelize those demands and those desires into policy action?
Right. I don't think there's a sort of clear-cut answer to that. But, you know, arguably, and I mentioned this in the book, you know, Parliament has, of course, become much more representative and diverse, particularly in its sort of caste composition. You know, of course, there were quotas or reservations put in place for the scheduled caste as well as the scheduled tribes. And then, you know, in the 90s, you know, post, you know, what is known as the Mandal Commission report and its implementation, we've had, you know, members of the other backward classes or the lower castes also getting much more representation in Parliament. Along with that, we've also seen, you know, a much greater diversity in the occupational composition of Parliament. So if you look at the early parliaments, you know, nearly a third of Parliament's representatives were lawyers. And subsequently, this has changed. We find, you know, more people from rural backgrounds, more people engaged in agriculture, etc., you know, being part of Parliament. So that's the good part. We've also seen sort of the committee system, which I mentioned, considerably expanding in the 1990s under Prime Minister Narasimha Rao. And that too has worked reasonably well. At the same time, there are serious representational deficits, particularly in terms of the low numbers of women. In fact, India's, you know, number of women representatives is far lower than the global, you know, average. And in fact, it's much lower than its South Asian neighbors, Pakistan, Bangladesh, for instance, partly because Bangladesh and Pakistan have quotas for women, which India has up till now not managed to do. Again, another worrying aspect is the low numbers of representation of minorities, particularly Muslims. So for instance, the current parliament, the one that got elected in 2019, has, you know, I think roughly, you know, 3.5, at least definitely under 4% Muslims, whereas the actual population of Muslims, it's 15%. So there's a wide gap between the number of, you know, Muslims in the Indian population and the percentage of elected MPs. So these are you know, firing aspects. Along with that, you know, we mentioned earlier, you know, the rise in the number of wealthy MPs, which actually is a pointer to the high cost of contesting elections, and again, those with criminal backgrounds. And I think both of this point to the high cost of elections, contesting elections, and the, you know, the high bar on entry into parliament. These, I think, are serious, you know, deficits of the Indian parliamentary system. Coupled with this, you know, the diversity, which, you know, is both has its both good as well as its sort of you know, weaker aspects. You know, diversity arguably has also led to disruptions and protests inside parliament, which has, you know, I think, taken a serious toll on parliament's functioning. So in short, you know, if I was to use, you know, Ramachandra Guha's, you know, famous characterization of Indian democracy, I would say it is sort of 50-50, you know, if one were to sort of look at, you know, parliament as a whole. But if we sort of, you know, come to the current phase, you know, post 2014, I would see, you know, certain other deficiencies, you know, besides the ones that I mentioned, which is part of the trend of institutions getting undermined, and parliament is no exception. And this, I think, is a worrying trend as we sort of look into the future. You know, despite the fact that I think, you know, parliament has been, you know, successful to a great extent in 75 years. But looking ahead, you know, I see, you know, there are certain sort of, you know, clouds on the horizon.
You know, you sort of answered in some sense both questions in one, because what you just said right now, I think, was a very eloquent encapsulation of the costs and benefits of deepening democratization on the transformation or functioning of parliament. You know, let me just ask you, since we sort of ended on a bit of an ominous note about, you know, the path forward, I want to ask you about the link between the kind of political balance of power and parliament's functioning. You know, in the book, you document the many ways in which parliament actually suffered during the coalition era, because it became very hard for disparate parties to forge a common understanding when you had so many coalition partners, a real fragmentation in Indian politics, a real regionalization of Indian politics. But in the current single party era, where we have a single hegemon in the form of Mr. Modi's BJP, parliament also seems to be struggling, right, under the weight of a rather domineering hegemonic party, which has sought to, say, undermine or circumvent the committee system, has sought to use money bills as a way of circumventing the say of the upper house. Some would say strong arm tactics on particular votes. Is the political balance of power, therefore, so central to determining how well the legislature functions, right? Because we've sort of seen it suffer under the weight of coalitions, and now some would argue suffer under the weight of a single party hegemon.
Right. You know, I think there are, you know, possibly two ways of looking at it. Say, for instance, if you consider disruptions, on which I have an entire chapter, and which in a sense is often seen as a defining sort of characteristic or feature of today's parliament. So for disruptions, a dominant party in parliament, you know, often actually leads to at least a superficially better functioning parliament in terms of productivity, since there is possibly less scope of disruptions as opposed to, you know, what you call, you know, a sort of fragmented polity or parliament. And this was in fact hinted at by, you know, Prime Minister A.B. Vajpayee in 2001, when he sort of addressed a conference which was on discipline and decorum in parliament and state legislatures, where he said that, you know, possibly in the first two decades of Indian, you know, parliamentary democracy, the very fact that there was, you know, one party rule meant that, you know, there were sort of less disruptions, you know, parliament was much more sort of, you know, functioned better, you know, in terms of the number of days it sat, in terms of number of legislations, etc. However, I would argue on other substantive aspects, you know, if you leave aside, you know, number of days parliament sits, the number of bills passed, you know, the amount of time lost to disruptions, On other aspects, a dominant party or hegemonic party can prove to be harmful. And we are seeing that in the current phase. For instance, one of the striking characteristics of the last two parliaments, in the beginning 2014, is we see that fewer bills are being referred to committees. So, for instance, in 2009 to 2014, if I remember the numbers correctly, I think roughly around 65% of the, or at least three quarters of the bills were being referred to committees, and committee inputs were being taken on board. But for the current parliament, the one that's been in session 2019, we see only a quarter, roughly around 25% of bills being referred to committees, and this I think has been disastrous. So, for instance, if we sort of many important bills have been pushed through without being referred to committees. For instance, I can off the top of my head recall, say, the legislation to abrogate the special status of Kashmir in Article 370, or for instance, the very controversial farm laws, which were pushed through without any serious discussion and without being referred to committees. So that's, I think, one of the sort of downsides of a dominant party. We've also seen, striking decline in bipartisanship, both on the floor of the House and in committees. And I would say, one of the sort of fallouts of a dominant party in parliament is in general disregard for the opposition and to give the opposition a voice. And you also mentioned very rightly that there are bills that are being pushed through as money bills, and the reference, I guess, is very prominently to the bill on the Aadhaar, or the unique identification the number, which has very wide ramifications, but was pushed through as a money bill precisely because in the upper house of the Rajya Sabha, at that point, the ruling party or the BJP did not have a majority. So these are things that the current dispensation, or any dispensation even earlier, and one can go back to the Indira Gandhi era, has done, which has bypassed the sort of checks and balances of parliament. Again, another example is the use of ordinances, which has seen a steep rise compared from 2014 onwards, compared, say, for the period from 2004 to 2014. So I think there are sort of various aspects, deleterious aspects, I would say, to a dominant party in parliament. And in contrast, coalition governments have often got the stick for being very messy, often chaotic, but arguably, coalition governments have also been more democratic and representative of different views. And this is something that's sometimes forgotten, because coalition governments are messy with very nature of various parties which have come together with very different sort of ideas of how to sort of govern India. And this has been noted, I think, by scholars who've studied coalition governments. And in fact, they've argued that coalition governments and coalition parliaments, in fact, have been much more consensus driven than parliaments that have been dominated by one party, as we see in the current instance.
My guest on the show this week is Ranajoy Sen. He is a senior research fellow at the Institute of South Asia Studies at the National University of Singapore. His new book is called House of the People: Parliament and the Making of Indian Democracy. The scholar Pratap Bhanu Mehta calls it a rich, historically nuanced, and engagingly written account of the making of India's parliament as an institution and the key tensions that marked its formation. Ranajoy, this will be a book that people will call upon for a long time as a kind of institutional biography of parliament. Congratulations, and thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you, Milan, for those kind words.
Granthamasha is a co-production of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the Hindustan Times. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you download your podcast. Be sure to subscribe and leave a review to help others find the show. Tim Martin is our audio engineer, and Cliff Jayapranada is our executive producer. Production assistance comes from Nithya Lab. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.
This was a Hindustan Times production, brought to you by HD Smartcast.
HD Smartcast.